I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. My name is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer here in the area. And each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science, both here in the Triangle area and elsewhere. We focus on one particular scientific topic of interest, talk to an expert or experts on the subject, and give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. If you'd like to do that, you can give us a call at 929-9601. And if you happen to be tuned in on the internet, you can just add the area code to that, which is 919. And recently we've put up a website for the program, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. All one word. And of course, your email comments are always welcome as well at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. Well, today on Radio In Vivo, we're going to be delving into the wonderful world of genetics. Before I introduce my guest, I want to give you just a little bit of background information that will give you some of the context for our discussion. When the human genome was sequenced a few years ago, many people thought that that was the big breakthrough. It was certainly an enormous advance, but it was kind of like having a roadmap without any legends as to what the streets were or the addresses or anything else. We knew where everything was and how much there was of it, but we still didn't know much about what it meant. And that's what's really important in terms of the return on our investment, the dividends in improving human health. Well, just a few short years later, we now know much more, and the pace of discovery is accelerating. Eventually, we'll have it all sorted out, and that's going to help usher in the era of personalized medicine, when you'll be able to go into your doctor's office, have your own individual genome scanned, and find out precisely which diseases you might be most at risk for because of your genetic makeup, and what you can do to prevent ever developing them. Also, your genome will tell your healthcare provider which drugs will work best for you, which won't work at all, and, most importantly perhaps, which drugs would be dangerous for you to take. This is all about the incredibly challenging and complicated pursuit of matching genotypes, that is, individual genetic patterns, to what the scientists call phenotypes, or the outcomes dictated by those patterns. That's the holy grail that's really going to pay off in terms of reducing the burden of disease on society, increasing our health and longevity, and vastly improving the efficiency of our healthcare delivery system, we hope. And right here in the Triangle, we have some folks who are working right at the cutting edge of all this, matching genotypes to phenotypes, characterizing the impact of the environment and how all of our exposures interact with our genes to cause disease or increase our susceptibility to disease. It's important to understand that a phenotype can be almost anything that manifests itself in an individual. Everything from having red hair to being a drug addict or alcoholic to getting cancer. The wide variety of individual characteristics that are either influenced or dictated by the specifics of our genomes are known in the trade as complex traits. And it's very difficult to get at the genetic underpinnings of those traits because they're typically determined by the interaction among many, many genes in multiple locations on our genomes. Characteristics that are determined by the action of a single gene are actually quite rare. Just since the human genome was mapped, there's been significant progress in understanding the all-important variations in our genes that make us who we are, and in starting to get a handle on how these things all work together. Well, believe it or not, some of the most advanced work in this arena is taking place in the mouse. There is an entire community of scientists around the world who do nothing but work on mouse genetics. And fortunately, much of what they discover translates directly to the human, since we share something like 98% of our genes with the rodents. A few weeks ago, many of the world's leading mouse geneticists gathered here in Chapel Hill for the fifth annual conference of a loosely knit but tightly bound organization called the Complex Trait Consortium. I had the pleasure of attending that meeting, and quite honestly, at first I didn't quite understand what these people did. Once I got a handle on that, I could really appreciate the dedication and excitement, the real thrill of discovery that these mouse geneticists so obviously shared. And this morning I'd like to try to take you on a similar journey. And so my guest today on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jeff French, who co-organized the meeting along with Professor David Threadgill of UNC. Jeff is with the NIEHS, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, which, as you may know, is one of the 27 National Institutes of Health and is headquartered right here at RTP. Jeff is a research physiologist by trade, and by title, he is group and discipline leader. That sounds a little kinky, Jeff, but we'll stay away from that. He is group and discipline leader in the Transgenic Carcinogenesis Lab, which is part of the Molecular Toxicology section of the Environmental Toxicology Program at the Institute. And kudos to me for getting through all that. Jeff got his PhD right here at NC State and has been with the NIEHS since 1982. Jeff, thank you so much for coming in on some short notice and sitting patiently through that long introduction and coming in to tell us all about complex traits on Radio In Vivo today.
Thanks, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here and participate in this experience. So.
Great. I'm going to change you over to this microphone, if you don't mind, Jeff. We're having a little technical issue here. Stand by.
Okay, is this a good radio
check?
There we
go. Now we're hearing
you. Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Before we get into the science itself, tell us a little bit more about mouse genetics itself and why the field is so important. Why do all of this in the mouse, and what does the mouse have to tell us?
Well, that's a very good question. There, as you said earlier, there's a lot of similarity between the mouse genomes and the human genomes in this question. And basically, the mouse, both the 400 or so inbred strains that exist in laboratories throughout the world, as well as the inbred wild strains of mice from around the world, allow us to manipulate these individual genomes in such a way that we can make them a research tool that allows us to emulate what's possible or simulate what's possible in the human.
I see.
For example, while the laboratory mice can be inbred to homozygosity, meaning that they have exactly each individual mouse has exactly the same copy in the same arrangement of each of the genes on each of the 20 mouse chromosomes. Mm-hmm. And in particular, it's also critical to note that the organizations of those genes, as they're linked together, are very similar to the way in which the same human genes are linked. In other words, there's this syntony, as scientists call it, between the two genomes, because that then takes not only the individual genes, but the organizations of genes that are linearly ordered together. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that allows us, in a relatively small animal, to be able to manipulate them in such a way that we can create research tools that we have significant confidence in that we can, for a large extent, emulate or simulate the human effects.
I see. And those are the kinds of things that in that type of research obviously cannot be conducted in humans. We can't go around manipulating human genes, right?
Exactly. Almost all populations of animals in nature, including humans, are basically heterozygous in nature, meaning that in both the haploid or the germ cells, as well as the diploid somatic cells, are of one type. And then when they are in the process of creation of an embryo, those the mother's genes and the father's genes are mixed together in such a way that they are now heterozygous. There can be two different forms of the same gene, which we often call allelic variants in this context.
Okay, so that's what really is at the basis of all the variation in the human race.
Absolutely, from the evolution of humans from in different parts of the world, and as they bred together over a long period of time, there was a concentration of these different forms of genes that can be traced back ancestrally to their origins, and we recognize today that a lot of the variation, human variation, is consistent with the origin of those. For example, Africans, Asians, Pacific Rim peoples, Europeans or Caucasians, even the Native Americans are Hispanic Indians of the different regions have higher frequencies of certain types of these forms of genes than the others do. Mm-hmm. And that makes it for a very interesting scenario for being able to understand complex traits. And most diseases are complex. It takes more than one gene. That is, they're multigenic, and these different forms of variation can therefore create or can be permuted into a large varieties that are difficult to sort out in the human.
Sure.
Therefore, the mouse is a very applicable model for this.
I see. Well, you mentioned complex traits, and we certainly want to spend a lot of time talking about those. But let's talk a little bit about the organization as a springboard to that. How did the Complex Trait Consortium get its start, and what is the purpose of the organization?
Well, mouse genetics is the focus, and in the complex the members of the complex traits, which it's not a formal organization, it's a group of international group of scientists that are brought together for the common purpose of improving and using mouse models of these complex trait diseases, whether that's in cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, obesity. Almost any observable phenotype in humans can be replicated in the mouse.
I see.
In that context. So they basically came together to try to improve the tools used by mouse geneticists. And the focus of this particular group was to try to create a thousand new lines, a thousand new inbred lines of mice with defined genetic organization.
Mm-hmm.
And they to do that, which was started in the right after the millennium started in 2000, we started an 8-way cross by selecting 8 different inbred strains, both of laboratory strains as well as inbred wild strains, to get maximum a variation in those genomes and cross them in such a way that over time 1,000 new lines with defined genotypes could be created, with the expectation and with a theoretical basis that those lines would have enough sufficient genetic diversity that we could simulate most human disease, and then more importantly, then we can actually know, we'll be able to actually identify from both biochemistry techniques as well as statistical techniques, be able to associate the gene products along with the in various admixtures to create a given phenotype and identify the exact genetic location of each of those.
So what you're talking about is what you folks call the collaborative cross.
Yes, it's been called the collaborative cross.
And when I know that the project is already well underway, when do you is it expected to be completed and ready for prime time?
Well, it's in progress, and we had basically at the recent meeting you mentioned, this fifth annual meeting of the CTC, our Complex Traits Consortium, we had some of the first reports there in that regard of the very beginning of the phenotyping of number of those lines. And the bottom line for those initial reports on this is to show that that the phenotypes can be observed, that they're consistent, and the genetics seems to be working as expected.
I see. So the ultimate goal of this 1,000 lines of genetically diverse mice, the progress report at this point, and I understand we're about 4 years away in terms of breeding.
Approximately another 4 years away of having 1,000 lines in place that can be maintained by normal breeding and husbandry practices, and characterizing each of those lines in that context. Yes.
Right. So what's happening now then is some pilot studies that are confirming that, yes, this is all on the right track, and we're heading in the right direction, and it looks like it's going to work.
Yes, it's very promising. The initial reports are very good, and it's still a long way to go. And I think a remarkable thing about this that your listeners should know, that this has been done largely gratis on the part of different laboratories. There has been no large government or industry sponsorship other than Oracle, the founder of Oracle, Larry Ellison, who has made a substantial grant to help promote this. But by and large, it's been done in such a way at minimal cost and as cost efficient as possible to produce this. So we're partway there. The proof in principle has been established, but we have, as you say, about 4 to 5 more years before each of those lines is available and beginning the exact characterization of each one. And what you should remember now is that basically these 8 founder lines of mice exhibit the same degree of allelic variation that can be observed in humans.
Or genetic diversity.
Genetic diversity.
Okay.
So basically, we know, and this is a very exciting part of actually the sequencing of the human genome, which you alluded to earlier, is that we recognize that rather than having 30,000 mouse or 30,000 human genes that can be mixed in all different proportions, which would be an astronomical number of combinations,
sure,
they actually are inherited and maintained in linearly related are blocks of genes. So that's given rise to the exciting field of looking at haplotypes, which is in the manner in which these genes are linked. And the structures of haplotypes in mouse models is very similar to that in humans. So we believe that we can replicate the genetic diversity, but we don't have to create each possible 30,000 combinations of 8 different lines because they have similar structures. So we now have complete sufficient genetic diversity, we believe, to make a valuable contribution to the study of these traits in mice and extrapolate that to the human condition and use that in terms of, as you put earlier, to try to begin the development of the basis of real individualized medicine.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about the low cost of the project, and I think it's certainly aptly named that it's called the Collaborative Cross, because one of the things I was very impressed with in attending the meeting was the real collaborative spirit of the 150 or so people who had come in from all over the world and don't necessarily all do the same thing. I take it that the membership really are committed to sharing and cooperating.
Absolutely. I mean, the use of the mouse as a tool is the link that holds everybody together. But as I'm sure you met, You met people there who were interested in behavior, who were interested in the pharmacological effects of drugs, individuals like myself interested in the effect of the environment and on disease, and particularly cancer in that context. So a great deal of expertise in all forms was there, but the link was the developing the tools in both the mouse models as well as the statistical tools by which to move this field forward. And I agree with you. I have learned more from the past three meetings of attending to this than I learned in graduate school. Of course, the field has moved far beyond the time I was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
But so much can be learned by having a group of scientists who are willing to completely share their expertise and their hard-earned reagents that are used as currency in this work.
And the animals themselves, to a great extent, I assume.
Yes. A great effort is put into sharing resources in terms of financial aspects, dollars that go into actually helping others maintain these lines of mice, which are readily made available to anyone throughout the world who wants to use these.
I heard so many conversations at the meeting of, you know, scientists from widely varying locations saying, hey, send me some of your mice and I'll send you some of mine.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think, as most scientists do, we have a great respect for the living systems that we use. And it's not in any way intended to be cavalier, because we have the great respect, I think, for life.
Sure.
And that we do this in such a way that we can learn and develop our knowledge base in this area to the maximum extent possible, and as cost efficient as possible, and both in terms of life as well as the financial support that we get. I mean, scientists are very very privileged in that position to be able to work and follow their instincts and their knowledge in developing this, and doing it basically by support from taxpayers and all other individuals who are willing to support this as we try to understand our individual differences
mm-hmm.
in this context.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, thank you for alluding to that. I'm glad you did. My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Jeff French from the NIEHS and one of the main people in the Complex Trait Consortium. So we are exploring the wonderful world of mouse genetics this morning. Jeff, I'd like to continue to... Let's get a little bit into the meat of the matter here, if you will. You know, there were more than 90 research results presented at the recent meeting, whether in poster form or in the form of oral presentations. And... could you give our listeners maybe just some of the highlights that will help give some examples of the types of traits we're talking about here and some of the methods mouse geneticists are using to characterize them?
Well, I'd be pleased to try.
Okay.
I hope that I can.
Okay.
One of the highlights was the presentation by Gary Churchill from the Jackson Labs, who is actually developing approaches to look at the dynamics of individual genomes and try to understand the entire the condition of that, all the way from how genes are expressed to what the consequence of the expression of those genes are.
That is turned on and off.
Turned on and off, yes. And then over time, you know, how in way in which those genes and their gene products react together in the context of a nucleus of a cell to maintain itself both functionally and structurally, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
And one of the factors that he brought up was new research in the area of actually how chromosomes are organized within the nucleus of the cell. And we often think of linearly in this context of how gene products are expressed And
when you
are,
say gene products, I'm
well, I mean, we talk about like proteins in this context, mm-hmm. for example, which might have both structural properties as well as enzymatic properties. Mm-hmm. The point I would like to make is that we're learning that that the control of these 30,000 plus genes are often controlled by other elements on the chromosome. But they're also sometimes controlled by elements on other chromosomes as they're spatially organized within the nucleus. It gives, in terms of systemic biology, it gives a lot more variability as to how these complex genomes interact together and how life can be maintained in these complex mammalian vertebrates with only 30,000 genes.
Right. That was a big shock when that came through,
yes,
wasn't it?
That's it was very surprising because before that, estimates range from 100,000 to 200,000 genes. And indeed, there may be that many different proteins that are ultimately metabolized and form all of the necessary structures for metabolism and physical structure. But it turns out that there are a lot fewer genes that actually code for these things than expected. So that's a big question still in biology and genetics as to how these things actually regulate them, how these genes regulate themselves and how expression is controlled. So,
sure.
So Gary's approaching this with a group of collaborators where he's actually looking at the dynamics of the genome and how the genome, how an individual cell, the genome of an individual cell reacts together. There were many talks. I probably will draw a blank now and can't remember the individuals.
That's okay.
But where some valuable new statistical tools have been developed, and you might appreciate now after this that we're the mathematics and the statistics underlie and underpin this area of research to a significant degree. Because by and large, gene-gene interactions can be identified only statistically mm-hmm. in this context. And
right.
trying to understand how in a complex trait, if I use the example of a cancer like a lymphoma, a blood disease, there can be, in different forms of that, that might be six or more different genes that can attribute and modify the effect, the development and the effect of that cancer. And it's very difficult to sort those out because they're not. We don't a priori know all of the genes involved in the pathways that lead to that. So statistical tools are very important, and a number mm-hmm. of new tools of way in ways in which to make these associations, that association between the expression of a given gene and that phenotype that you described, the outcome of that. How we can sort those out and determine on a probability basis the association between those.
Mm-hmm.
That provides a valuable link to actually identifying the region of the chromosome and the locus of that gene where it might be and actually undergoing the necessary proofs to demonstrate that it's that gene that contributes this amount of effect to a given phenotype.
And it's very difficult to separate out the signal, as it were, from the noise.
Yeah,
here, right?
Absolutely. One of the biggest problems when in complex traits and based on so many genes interacting together, both in a positive way as well as an epistatic way, that is where one gene interferes with a product of another gene and alters that, is very, very difficult. So the improving the signal and trying to eliminate the effect of the noise so that you can actually judge this is very critical. So statistics plays a valuable role.
So we really should have paid more attention
we should
in statistics
have, yes,
class.
We should have paid more attention because I think you'll agree that life is a lot that way. We should not know more about probability so we can assess the risk to ourselves in many ways. A number of new reports were discussed where, example, in the terms of atherosclerosis, that is the disease of the vascular system or the blood vessels mm-hmm. that affect us, there has been remarkable agreement between what is observed, the phenotype in the mouse, and identifying those genes in a mouse that have a tremendous impact on that, and finding that by determining that first in the mouse, the labs at the Beth Pagan's lab at the Jackson Laboratory, where these reports were given by some of her postdoctoral research fellows at the meeting, to show that there are indeed human corollaries to that. So it has been very amazing that new genes that have impact on this disease have been discovered through these observations in the complex traits observed in the mouse. So the mouse-human connection, at least we know that there are significant differences between the two animals.
Sure.
But the basic, highly conserved regions of the genome are very similar, and many of the same pathways leading to disease are very similar. So it has demonstrated further that there's a valuable tool here to be employed to try to understand human disease.
Absolutely.
So those are three highlights that I would bring out.
What about some of the behavioral aspects you mentioned?
Well, that's true. I mean, I think you did talk to Abraham at the meeting, who was very interested in a basically psychopharmacological approach to understanding things. He had been working on genetic tools for this in mice. He had happened to move from New York City to Chicago, where he made a collaboration with one of his new colleagues there, who had actually had been collecting data and patients for a long time, and was able to use that tool with his work and actually pinpoint some particular chemical differences in humans that relate also again to the mouse and the human. That was a very valuable tool.
Right.
That was developed.
And that was Abraham Palmer of the University of Chicago, just to give him due credit.
Absolutely.
And he was actually, I found his study just fascinating. He was studying methamphetamine addiction, and was able to model it in the mouse population, and then also start looking for that same genetic underpinning in humans.
Yes. I forget the name of his colleague there, who is a psychiatrist, I believe, who was working at the University of Chicago, who had been collecting this data on methamphetamine addiction, and it turned out to be a very, very valuable tool for both of them.
But it seemed to me that was a perfect example of where, you know, just one example of where this field really is headed in terms of really coming up with some very, very significant understandings that, especially once the collaborative cross is completed and people have started working with it, this is really going to start translating out into human knowledge and hopefully out to the clinic and bedside, right?
I agree with you. I think Abraham's discovery was hard-earned, but it was more or less serendipitous that he happened to move to a place where he actually was able to actually make that extrapolation, that connection with human addiction.
As is so often the case in science.
Yeah. The mouse model has been very important in alcohol addiction. Almost all of the dopamine-based type addictions has been very critical to those. And I think it's because we never know exactly what gene. We might be interested in one field, and it turns out to be that gene has a profound impact in a totally different phenotype, being studied only by behaviorists, as you just mentioned. So you never know in science exactly where it's going to lead you, but we know that we have to make that effort if we're going to make any progress.
Which is, of course, why conferences like the one you just had are so important, when you get this disparate group of people together that have this commonality and can really learn a lot of interesting things from each other.
You're right. It's quite remarkable sometimes. As a co-organizer with David Threadgill from UNC, you never know exactly what mix of people and what the outcome is going to be. But we were very pleased that that there was a dynamic in that meeting that was similar to previous meetings, but it seemed to move us a bit further along, and it helps reinforce, you know, sometimes working in science, even in biomedical sciences, you can go years sometimes without finding something very significant. Mm-hmm. But meetings like this can actually accelerate that process by making connections that you would not have thought of otherwise in that context. So it's been very valuable for that specific purpose, as you mentioned.
Sure. Jeff, clarify one thing for me and hopefully our listeners as well. You know, anyone who's had some knowledge of this field is familiar with the models that have been used in the past called knockout mice, where one particular gene is turned off or deleted. And
yes,
that has implications in see what happens in terms of a particular disease. But this is really far beyond that, is it not?
Well, yeah, let's try to make a connection between those two, because there is a lot of research that goes on looking at one gene at a time. And it is certainly true that transgenesis, that the discovery of the ability to move a gene from into a specific organism, whether it's a transgene that happens to be randomly located within the genome, or knocking out a very specific gene,
mm-hmm,
to look for that phenotype as a consequence to the loss of that product. It might be total loss, or it might be a 50% loss if you knock out only one copy of the gene. But that's looking at phenotypes one gene at a time. Like in my own research, that's critical because I've been studying the tumor suppressor gene P53, which is one of the critical gatekeeper genes in suppressing cancer, and it does it very effectively in both mouse and in humans.
Sure.
And we know the phenotype of that when it's completely deficient in P53, and when it's haploinsufficient or having only half the normal amount, and that loss sets up a stage of events that's very similar in the mouse and in the human,
mm-hmm,
that actually results in a truncation or a decrease in the amount of time it takes to go from a normal condition to a malignancy in that context. So that sort of anchors the phenotype, if you will. We talk about the cancer being a phenotype.
Mm-hmm.
That anchors that loss, anchors that. And what I've been doing is looking at the consequence of that in different strains of mice and looking for the genes that actually impact that. For example, in some mice, they're very predisposed to getting certain types of cancer, others are not. But I can study the interaction of the different individual genomes of those inbred mice in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we can employ those, both looking at one gene at a time as well as using them as tool to look for the complex traits or the multigenic traits in this context.
I see.
And now we've moved on from these whole genome knockouts to scientists that have developed tools for making what we call conditional knockouts by using a new mechanism by which these genes can be knocked out only in certain tissues.
Uh-huh.
We can study the effect of the loss of that gene in a particular tissue. For example, in the bone marrow or in the blood of a mouse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It, likewise, we can also then take these different forms of genes that we've talked about in terms of this vast genetic differences exist in different genomes, and actually knock in different allelic variants in those and look at the outcome of just changing the haplotype for that one gene. And by haplotype, I meant all of the single nucleotide polymorphic differences that exist on that sequence of DNA,
mm-hmm,
and the outcome
all the various genetic variations.
All of the genetic variations. Sorry to bring in some.
That's
some
okay.
Terms. You know, I'm used to talking with scientists sometimes, and I know you have a very literate and well learned audience here in Carrboro. So we're not talking down in any way.
Not a bit. We're going to keep you honest, though.
Okay, well, that's very good. So so those tools are very important as well, and we're finding ways now of linking those various tools together, because many complex traits develop over long periods of time. So in most models, and model being sometimes useful, sometimes not, we're trying to find the ones which we can work with and give us solid answers. But, you know, for the sake of cost and efficiency and in time, we try to truncate those models as much as possible, as reduce the time it takes to manifest those diseases as possible.
Sure. Well, I know that you work in the area of cancer, Jeff, and you know, certainly one of the things that has emerged over the last several years in that field is the molecular basis of the disease.
Yes.
There's a myriad of different forms, and they hit people in different ways and are developed in completely different ways. And certainly interactions with the environment and genes are critical to it. So I take it that the mouse and the type of work you're doing is modeling along that path to where we can hopefully start getting a handle on some of that.
Yeah, I think that's true, Ernie, for a number of diseases that may have a large environmental component to them, and I think you've raised an important issue in that context. We don't always know how the environment or components of the environment interact with various genetic components of individuals. And
when we talk about the environment here, we're using the broad definition.
The broadest definition possible.
These days.
Absolutely, because we all live in our own little niche of things, because we eat the foods that we like, we eat the amount of foods that we like sometimes to our own detriment.
Right.
For whatever reason, we've chosen various vocations. We might be working in a welding shop that has various toxic properties to it, or in a fuel station where we're exposed to benzene in fairly large amounts over time. So we inevitably in our modern world, we are exposing ourselves either at work or at home to various things that can have a consequence to our health over time. And so one of the primary goals of the NIHS is to understand that relationship between the environment and the impact of potential toxic properties of the environment to the individual. I remember listening to one of your earlier programs and listening to Sam Wilson discuss about this very question in terms of this, because we know that our genome is made up of a lot of environmentally responsive genes, and based on our own individual genetic variations, we respond to those insults or to those environmental changes in different ways. And that's one of the things that we believe this approach to understanding complex traits will help us understand that. Because Sam had discussed in general twin studies, which has been very important, and some of the best ones have been done in Northern Europe, where there's a very good medical record of individuals and of twins, and we understand that for different diseases, and particularly different cancers, that there are varying components of both of the environment or the individual's genetics, because we see for some types of cancers, there's no difference between twins who have the same genetic makeup, and others there's very dramatic differences between twins. So we know from the inference from those studies that sometimes there's a larger environmental component than there is a heritability component, and vice versa. So it's sorting those things out so that we know to an individual what the ultimate risk is under given conditions. Because I think all of us want to protect our individual rights, but we also all want to know ways in which we can promote our health and reduce our risk to long-term consequences to these things. So whether we're at risk for addiction, or whether we're at risk for obesity, or whether we're at increased risk for cancer, because we know in our family there's been a history of it, and we would like to understand that so we can make the kinds of intelligent decisions that we hope one day will be possible.